For those who have been in church for some time, if I were to give you descriptions of various biblical figures, I'd say most of you would be able to identify them because you've heard the description so often. For instance, man after God's own heart is David. Father of the faithful, Abraham. Apostle of love, John. Impetuous, Peter. Self-righteous, Job. That hyphenated word, self-righteous, does not appear in the Bible. New World Dictionary of the American Language defines it this way as an adjective, filled with or showing one's own conviction of being morally superior or more righteous than others, smugly virtuous, morally righteous than others. Is this Job's problem? Is Job comparing himself to others in this book? Religious works point to the Pharisees in general, and an example in Luke chapter 18 in particular, as an example of self-righteousness. Notice this to begin with, Luke chapter 18, verses 9 to 12. This is the comparison of two individuals, but only one is comparing himself to others. Luke chapter 18, we find the Pharisee who now goes up and makes his prayer in the temple. Luke 18, beginning with verse 9, it says, "Also he spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, 'God, I thank you that I am not like other men.'" Notice the comparison. "I'm not an extortioner. I'm not unjust. I'm not an adulterer. Or even like this character over here, the tax collector. I fast twice in the week. I give tithes of all that I possess." If we want an example of self-righteousness, it is here in Luke chapter 18. But again, is this Job's problem? Before going forward with Job's comments, let us review Job chapter 1 and 2. Job chapter 1 and 2. We have covered two parts of this book so far. We are dealing now with part 3. I was going to eliminate part 4, but in reviewing it this morning, looking at Elihu's comments this morning, I cannot eliminate Elihu. And that final message will be Job's encounter with God. Job chapter 1, verse 5. It says, "So it was when the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them, his children, after they had partied. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them. For Job said, 'It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.' Thus Job did regularly. If there is sin committed, even if there is just the fleeting thought, Job dealt with it. He dealt with it." Continuing on down here in verse 8, it says, "Then the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and an upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?' God said that the man was righteous." Satan could not find a flaw in this man. Self-righteousness is a sin. It is a major sin. As Christ now is bringing out his diatribe time and time again against the self-righteous Pharisees. Do you see that in Job? Continuing on, verse 9, it says, "So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his house, around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face.'" As we talked about this, this is Satan's belief of us as human beings, that we have ulterior motives for serving God. That if God removed blessings from us, we would stop serving God. That our reason for serving God is because God blesses us. If God now starts pouring out problems upon us, we would back down. If we went through what Job was going through, in Satan's mind, we would quit. We throw in the towel. And so this book is written to show Satan, as well as us, that there are people who will serve God even if they are not blessed. And so we find God allows Satan to go away from his presence and start the cursing of Job, taking away his property, having all of his children killed. Verse 20, Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and he worshiped. I emphasize that verse, that here we find he falls down and worships. Most of us would ask, why is this happening to me? This is so unfair. All of that he is going through, he falls down and he worships. Verse 21, and he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked shall I return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Job did not sin. Verse 22, he did not sin, nor did he charge God with wrongdoing at all. Awesome attitude. God knew he would not give up even though he was cursed. Going into chapter 2, verse 3, the Lord said to Satan, who came again, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man?" He could not say that about someone if his problem was self-righteousness. A blameless, upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity. "Although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause." We don't know all that God had in mind from this. We only have little glimpses of it. But certainly God had his own purpose behind it all. Satan now was an instrument in his hand to bring Job to a certain development of character in his life that he had not reached. As you drop down in all of this, God sent him away to even afflict Job with sickness. In verse 10 it says, "But he said to his wife, 'You speak as one of the foolish women speak. Shall we indeed accept good from God? Shall we not accept adversity?' And all this Job did not sin with his lips." Now something is going on within his heart. Now you keep in mind what it says here. He has not sinned. He did not sin in his heart. He did not sin in his lips. This is an example of righteousness, but we come to chapter 3, there is a definite change. Change in his attitude from what he says in chapter 1, verse 20, when he fell down and he worshiped and he said, naked I came from my mother's womb. Blessed be the name of the Lord forever and ever, to chapter 3. Chapter 3 can be divided into three parts. The first 10 verses, Job wants a curse placed on the day of his birth. I'm moving now from the New King James to the New Living Translation. I pointed out before when we're going through poetic books, the third book of the Old Testament, the third division of the Old Testament, the writings, it's good to go through a modern translation in the writings, Book of Psalms, Proverbs. It's good to go through a modern translation, and that's no different with this book of Job. Notice in verse 1, as I'm reading again, as I said, from the New Living Translation, at last Job spoke, and he cursed the day of his birth, a day of darkness, a day of clouds, blackness. Let no one rejoice on that day. Let it be a day of cursings. Job is crying out, why was I ever born? First question. Second division of chapter 3, verses 11 to 19. Verses 11 to 19, he desires death. He desires death. Verse 11, why didn't I die at birth as I came from the womb? Now his first question, why was I ever born? Now he asks, why didn't I die when I came out of the womb? The third division of the chapter, verses 20 to 26. Verses 20 to 26, he questions God's purpose in the sore trial. Verse 23, why is life given to those with no future? Those destined by God to live in distress. Verse 25, what I always feared has happened to me. What I dreaded has come to me. I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest. Instead, only trouble comes and keeps coming and keeps coming. And so his third question emerges. His first question, why was I born? His second question, but having been born, why didn't I die when I came out of the womb? And his third question, and since that did not happen, why can't I die now? It's a bad mindset, huh? I don't think Job is thinking of suicide. I believe he wants God to either end the suffering or take his life. One or the other. If he's contemplating suicide, he can kill himself. I don't think that's in his thinking. He places this now at the throne of God. End this or take my life. At this point, the whole book shifts its focus. We come to the heart of the book, the dialogue, the debate between Job and his three friends. They come to mourn him and to comfort him, but they accuse him of committing some heinous crime. And that was our focus last time in part 2 on the book of Job. They each take 3 rounds with Job. First, they state the theological view. Obviously, you've committed some sin, Job. Repent, things will get better. Then they try sarcasm and irony. And the third round, they go out with a flat-out attack on Job. His reaction was, at first he was irritated with his three friends, but then he becomes angry with them, and finally he is sarcastic. We are dealing with his problem as it unfolds now. We will look at his responses to his three friends, and we will see a problem beginning to unfold as we move through. We start in chapter 6, verse 24. Chapter 6, verse 24. Here he says, all I want is a reasonable answer. Then I will be quiet. tell me, what have I done wrong? Job is simply saying, if there is something wrong, tell me, for I don't know what it is. His dilemma is that he knows God is doing this to him, but he doesn't know why. He knows that there is nothing in his life that he hasn't repented of. He has searched his mind, his heart, I am sure, day after day after day. He's not necessarily claiming that he's sinless. But if there is sin that he is knowledgeable of, when you look at chapter 1, this man dealt with it. So now he is looking, what is the sin that I have committed? Three friends are accusing him of committing some sin. Tell me what the sin is. I have gone from A to Z and I cannot find out what it is, if that is the reason. Tell me what's going on. The first five verses of chapter 7, I won't read those. But chapter 7, 1 to 5, gives an indication this trial has been going on for months and possibly years. Years. We pick it up in chapter 7, verse 7. O God, remember that my life is but a breath, and I will never again experience pleasure. You see me now, but not for long. Your eyes will be on me, but I will be dead. Just as a cloud dissipates and vanishes, those who die will not come back. They are gone forever from their home, never to be seen again. He's given up, throwing his hands up in the air. He thinks he will never see any relief coming, that this is going to continue, all of this pain, to the end of his life. And out of that meaningless suffering and hopelessness and despair, he starts to cry out, verse 11, I cannot keep from speaking. I must express my anguish. I must complain in my bitterness. Am I a sea monster that you place a guard on me? We are starting to get bow. Who am I, God? Moby Dick? That must mean, God, you're Captain Ahab. He doesn't say that. That's implied. Verse 13, if I think my bed will comfort me and I will try to forget my misery with sleep, you shatter me with dreams. You terrify me with visions. Verse 15, I would rather die of strangulation than go on and on like this. I hate my life. I do not want to go on living. Oh, leave me alone for these few remaining days. What are mere mortals that you should make so much of us? For you examine us every morning. You test us every moment. Why won't you leave me alone, even for a moment? Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of all humanity? Why have you made me your target? Am I a burden to you? Why not just pardon my sin and take away my guilt? For soon I will lay down in the dust and die. When you look for me, I will be gone. He's expressing his frustration at this lingering trial, but also at God. You ever felt that sense of futility, of hopelessness? God, this trial has just been going on and on and on. Please, ended. If not, and if you are responsible, leave me, God. Leave me alone, please. I've had enough of all of this. Be it sickness, be it a marital problem. But looking at this, Is this self-righteousness or what? Or what? We see the overall picture. Job doesn't. And his problem is starting to unfold. Chapter 9, verse 3. Chapter 9, verse 3. If someone wanted to take God to court, would it be possible to answer him even once in 1,000 times? He's getting bolder. He wants to go to court with God. And if he is able to accomplish that, he is ready to prove his innocence. Therefore, if he is innocent, what does that make God? Oh, dropping down in chapter 9, verse 21, I am innocent, but it makes no difference to me. I despise my life. Innocent or wicked, it is all the same to him. That is why I say he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. He laughs when a plague suddenly kills the innocent. Extremely insane comment, Job. That God is laughing over in Indonesia when a tsunami kills thousands and thousands? That God is laughing when an earthquake destroys the lives of hundreds in Haiti? That God is laughing over a single American Afghan who is killed by an IED over in Afghanistan? God is laughing? That's an insane comment. Something is happening to this man. Verse 24, the whole earth is in his hands, in the hands of the wicked. And God, not in his hands, in the hands of the wicked. And God blinds the eyes of the judges and lets them be unfair. If not he, then who? You are blinding the eyes of judges so that they will administer unfair judgments. And if it's not you, then who is doing it? There's nobody greater than you. Verse 32, God is not a mortal like me, so I cannot argue with him or take him to trial. If only there were a mediator who could bring us together, but there is none. The mediator could make God stop beating me, and I would no longer live in terror of his punishment. Then I could speak to him without fear, but I cannot do that in my own strength. You're saying what is needed here is a mediator who can come between the two of us, who is fair and unbalanced, imbalanced and balanced, and unbiased. And he can determine who is right and who is wrong. And I know the mediator will say that I am right. If I am right, what is he saying? Is this self-righteousness or what? What is happening here? Do you see what is going on? He does sin. There is no question. Because he does repent in chapter 42. And it is a model example of repentance. But what is he repenting of? Chapter 10, beginning with verse 1. He says, I am disgusted with my life. Let me complain freely. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, don't simply condemn me. Tell me the charge you are bringing against me. What do you gain by oppressing me? Why do you reject me, the work of your own hands, while sending joy and prosperity to the wicked? God, you are rewarding the wicked over here, and I've been trying my best to please you. And you're punishing me. Is that self-righteousness? Do you see what is unfolding? Drop down verse 20. He says, I have only a little time left, so leave me alone, that I may have a little moment of comfort. His cry is, let me know, or let me go. One or the other. Go through feelings of this. Explain this to me, God. If not, can you please just leave me be? Chapter 13 describes how, through the long hours of anguish, he is planning what he would say if God ever gave him a chance to say it. He first pleads for certain conditions that he feels is necessary before he is able to stand and talk to God. Verse 18 of chapter 13. I have prepared my case. So he's coming back to this. I have prepared my case. I will be proved innocent. Who can argue with me over this? If you could prove me wrong, I would remain silent until I die. Oh God, there are two things I beg of you, and I will be able to face you. Verse 21, remove your hand from me and don't terrify me with your awesome presence. Other words, just lift the pain, will you? It's hard for me to speak through this pain and this torment. And secondly, veil your presence because I don't want to be terrified by your awesome appearance. But what is he doing? What is he doing? Next is his appeal for knowledge. Verse 22. Now summon me and I will answer. Or let me speak to you and you reply. Tell me, what have I done wrong? Show me my rebellion and my sin. Why do you turn away from me? Why do you consider me your enemy? Again, is this self-righteousness or what? Frustration? Yes. Discouragement? Yes. Bitterness? Yes. And something else. And something else. Then in chapter 14, Job brings out the helplessness and hopelessness of man before God. And he kind of compares God to a big bully. Verse 1, how frail is humanity? How short is life? And how full of trouble? Like a flower, we blossom for a moment and then wither. Like a shadow of a passing cloud, we quickly disappear. Verse 5, you have decided the length of our lives. You know how many months we will live, and we're not given a minute longer. So give us a little rest, won't you? Turn away your angry stare. We are like hired hands, so let us finish the task you have given to us. Leave us be. Saying man is helpless before God. Basis of his plea. In verses 7 to 12, he continues this sense of futility. If a tree is cut down, there is hope that it will sprout again and grow new branches. Though its roots have grown old and the earth and its stump decays, at the scent of water it may bud and sprout again like a new seedling. But when people die, they lose all strength. They breathe their last, and then where are they? As water evaporates from a lake, And as a river disappears in a drought, people lie down to do and do not rise again until the heavens are no more. They will not wake up nor be roused from their sleep. Seems to contradict what he is about to say when he makes the comparison on how the tree, when it is cut down, it gets some water and it just ends up sprouting once again. But when you die, it's like that's it. But yet he says, verse 13, I wish you would hide me with the dead and forget me there until your anger has passed. But mark your calendar to think of me again. If mortals die, can they live again? This thought would give me hope, and through my struggle, I would eagerly wait for release. Let me read that out of the New King James, because we have incorporated that in the past for years in our funeral ceremony, as he now makes this statement in chapter 14. In the right chapter, verse 14, beginning with verse 13 again. Oh, that you would hide me in the grave, that you would conceal me until your wrath is past. Your wrath is past, that you would appoint me a set time and remember me. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my hard service, I wait till my change comes. That seems to contradict what he has just stated earlier. And he brings out that contradiction also further in chapter 19. It's as if Job knew about a resurrection. And this would be one of the earliest biblical records of a resurrection from the dead. Remember, this is possibly the oldest Old Testament book. And we have a reference now to the resurrection. Job goes on to state the facts as he understands them. Chapter 16, beginning with verse 7. O God, you have ground me down and devastated my life. You have reduced me to skin and bones as proof, they say, of my sins. God hates me and tears angrily at my flesh. He gnashes his teeth at me and pierces me with his eyes. He likens God to a wild animal, and he the helpless victim. You get the impression like the Roman Colosseum when those lions were released. And they went out before the innocent Christians and just literally ripped them apart. This is his description of God. You are like a vicious animal. Bold? Verse 10. People jeer and laugh at me. They slap my cheek in contempt. A mob gathers against me. God has handed me over to sinners. He has tossed me into the hands of the wicked. I was living quietly until he broke me apart. He took me by the neck, dashed me to pieces. Then he set me up as his target. His archers surrounded me, and his arrows pierced me without mercy, and the ground is wet with my blood. I'm just target practice for God. God's extremely patient, okay? I mean, we've gone through enough chapters, enough to figure out, hey, we got a serious problem here. But God is very patient with Job. Go over to chapter 19, beginning with verse 23. He continues, oh, that my words could be written. Oh, that they could be inscribed on a monument. Job, they are. In the Bible, and you come up in the resurrection, most likely the first one is we believe it, and you're going to see it right there. Oops. Oops. Verse 24 says, carved with an iron chisel, filled with lead, engraved forever in the rock. But as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives and that he will stand upon the earth at last, immortalized by Handel. Several times he talks about an intervener, a mediator in chapter 9, describes him as a witness in chapter 16, and now a redeemer here in chapter 19, verse 26. After my body has decayed, yet in my body or apart from my body, I will see God. I will see him for myself. Yes, I will see him with my own eyes. I am overwhelmed at that thought. Again, this contradicts the first part of chapter 14. This is that early reference to a resurrection. Not dealing with that as a doctrinal issue. We're dealing with Job's problem. Chapter 21 now, verse 4. Chapter 21, verse 4. He says, my complaint is with God, not with people. No wonder I am so impatient. You guys, as you speak, you are not my problem. Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, you're not my problem. God is my problem. Do you begin to see his problem? Dropping down, verse 22. But who can teach a lesson to God, the supreme judge? One person dies in prosperity and security, the very picture of good health. Another person dies in bitter poverty, never having tasted the good life. Both alike and buried in the same dust, both eaten by the same worms. Life seems to be so unfair. And this is what causes many people to be troubled by the claims of Christianity that God is a loving God, that God is just, God is holy. You hear the questions raised. If there is a good God, why does he allow this kind of thing to happen? Why, as he even brings out here, the wicked are prosperous and they die at times surrounded by luxury? Why is it that the poor person dies in poverty? Why are you doing this, God? Job is raising the same question. That brings us then to chapters 23 and 24. He asks two questions, one in chapter 23, one in chapter 24. And these are the great unanswered questions that men continue to ask today. In chapter 23, Job is asking, why is God so seemingly absent from human affairs? Why is he absent? Chapter 23, verses 3 to 5, if only I knew where to find God, I would go to his throne and talk with him there. I would lay out my case and present my arguments. Then I would listen to his reply and understand what he says to me. Would he? When you get into a frame of mind like that, is it possible? Chapter 24, why is God silent? Why doesn't he just judge evil? Verse 1 of chapter 24, why doesn't the Almighty open the court and bring judgment? Why must the godly wait for him in vain? We have a tendency to generalize. When we might see suffering of the poor, when we might be going through difficulties ourselves, we have a tendency to extrapolate that to everyone. That if I am serving God, I should not have to experience pain. If I am serving God, my marriage should be perfect. If I am serving God, I should not get sick. What is our problem here? In chapter 27, Job begins his final speech. After responding to Bildad, he starts in chapter 27, verse 1. Job continued speaking. I make this vow by the living God, who has taken away my rights, by the Almighty who has embittered my soul. Reason I'm in this bitter spirit, God. As long as I live, while I have breath from God, my lips will speak no evil, my tongue will speak no lies. I will never concede that you are right until I die. I will defend my innocence. I will maintain my innocence without wavering. My conscience is clear for as long as I live. I have done no wrong. This is all God's fault. Chapter 28, he gives an analogy of searching for gold to searching for wisdom, which is necessary in sore trials. It ties in well with James 1, 2-8, where he says, count it all joy when you fall into different trials and temptations, knowing that the trying of your faith works patience. Let patience have its perfect work. May be perfect, entire, lacking nothing. If you don't understand, ask. You lack wisdom, ask. In the next three chapters, he reviews for us all that has happened to him. In chapter 29, he looks back at the good old days. As he mentions his blessings back in the good old days. Chapter 29, verse 1. Job continued speaking. I long for the years gone by when God took care of me, when he lighted the way before me, and I walked safely through the darkness. In my early years, the friendship of God was felt in my home. The Almighty was still with me, and my children were around me. In those days, my cows produced milk in abundance. My olive groves poured out streams of olive oil. Ah, the good old days. Remember the good old days? You know, even when we go through collectively trials in the church, we can look back to the good old days, the 50s, the 60s. They weren't good for some. Then he describes the honor he experienced. Verse 7. Those were the days when I went to the city gate, took my place among the honored leaders. The young stepped aside when they saw me, and even the aged rose and respected my coming. The princes stood in silence and put their hands over their mouths. The highest officials of the city stood quietly, holding their tongues in respect. And who heard of me, all who heard of me praised me. All who saw me spoke well of me. Good old days. Boy, was I up on that pedestal then. I had great respect from everyone. Then he speaks of the good deeds he delighted in doing. Verse 12. I helped the poor in their need, the orphans who had no one to help them. That's not self-righteousness. It's doing what God told him to do. I helped those who had lost hope, and they blessed me. And I caused the widow's hearts to sing for joy. All I did was just and honest. Righteousness covered me like a robe, and I wore justice like a turban. I served as eyes for the blind, feet for the lame. I was a father to the poor and made sure that even strangers received a fair trial. I broke the jaws of godless oppressors and made them release their victims. Can you look at that as a Pharisee doing what he did? Can you compare what Job is doing to a Pharisee? I look at what he did in his formative years of work with God as fulfilling Matthew 5:48, be you perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. The man was righteous. This trial brought on now by God through Satan has changed his heart. In verses 18 to 20, he tells his hope, what his hopes were. I thought, surely I will die surrounded by my family after a long, good life. Who wouldn't want that? Verse 19, for I am like a tree whose roots reach the water, whose branches are refreshed with the dew. New honors are constantly bestowed on me, and my strength is continually renewed. In other words, when I die, I just want to be able to have my family around me. Everything is just going to be hunky-dory. Just let me close my eyes, look at my family. It's been nice knowing your family. Kaboom. Why? Because I obeyed God. Doesn't always work out that way. We brought it out a couple of weeks ago when we talked about Thanksgiving, where Elihu makes this comment in chapter 36, in which you think that as you obey God, you spend your days in prosperity and joy. That's a myopic view. He concludes the section by describing his influence. Verse 21, everyone listened to me and valued my advice. They were silent as they waited for me to speak. And after I spoke, they had nothing to add, for my counsel satisfied them. They longed for me to speak as they longed for rain. They waited eagerly for my words, were as refreshing as the spring rain. When they were discouraged, I smiled on them. My look of approval was precious to them. I told them what they should do and presided over them as a chief, as their chief. I live as a king among his troops and as one who comforts those who mourn. Those were the good old days. Chapter 30, we get to the other side, the dark side, the present pain. He begins the first 15 verses by describing how men mock him. Verse 1 says, but now I am mocked by those who are younger than I, by young men whose fathers are not worthy to run with my sheepdogs. He is probably describing some of the evil riffraff of his day. And now that is passed down to their children, and these children now are mocking him. Verse 9, and now their sons mock me with their vulgar song. They taunt me, they despise me, and won't come near me except to spit in my face. Not easy. This trial that he is going through. And before we think in terms, boy, if I'd gone through that, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't be making these questions about God. Probably not, because we probably would have cursed God like Satan said. This man is an outstanding example, as God said, of righteousness. But Satan did get to him. Satan did get to him. In verses 11 to 15, he describes their insults and their attacks. Verses 16 to 19, the anguish of this physical pain Note that, verse 19, 16 of chapter 30. And now my heart is broken. Depression haunts my days. My weary nights are filled with pain as though something were relentlessly gnawing at my bones. With a strong hand, God grabs my garment. He grips me by the collar of my tunic. He has thrown me into the mud. I have become as dust and ashes. God has bullied me. I've been like in a dark alley, and he's been the thief, and he has held me up with his weapons, grabbed me around the nape of the neck, and he has thrown me down in the mud. Self-righteous. Verse 20, I cry to you, O God, but you don't answer me. I stand before you and you don't bother to look. You have become cruel toward me. You persecute me with your great power. You throw me into the whirlwind and destroy me in the storm. And I know that you are sending me to my death, the destination of all who live. Surely no one would turn against the needy when they cry for help. Did I not weep for those in trouble? Was I not deeply grieved for the needy? So I looked for good, but evil came. I am now needy. I have helped those who have been in need time and time again. Now I am in need. Where are you? Where are you? He goes on to describe how he feels persecuted by God. Yet he cries out to God, and God doesn't answer. This is the problem that a lot of us have at times when we deal with unanswered prayers. Not realizing, as Elihu will bring out, God very well may have answered the prayer. We just don't even know it. We're looking for our own answer. And that's certainly the case with him. Verse 27, my heart is troubled and restless. Days of affliction have come upon me. I walk in gloom without sunlight. I stand in the public square and cry for help. But instead, I am considered a brother to jackals and a companion to ostriches. My skin has turned dark. My bones burn with fever. My harp plays sad music, and my flute accompanies those who weep, because I am singing the blues. And we come to his final words in chapter 31. In chapter 31, he gets, as Job comes to this point, he makes a summation of it all. All that he has gone through. I'll start at verse 1 with the New Living Translation, but I'm going to go through this in the New King James. Verse 1 of chapter 31, he says, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look with lust upon a young woman. It's not self-righteous. That's obedience to God. But read what this man has done in his life. The covenant that he established with himself and with God in his life. Starting with verse 5. If I have walked with falsehood or lied, or if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed on honest scales that God knows my integrity. I am not guilty. Verse 7. If my step has turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes, or if any spot adheres to my hands, I am not guilty. Verse 9. If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, I am not guilty. Verse 13, if I have despised the cause of my male or female servants when they complained against me. What then shall I do when God rises up? I am not guilty. Verse 16, if I have kept the poor from their desire or caused the eyes of the widow to fail, not guilty. Verse 19, if I have seen anyone perish from lack of clothing, or any poor man without covering, if his heart has not blessed me, and if he has not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless, I am not guilty. Verse 24, if I have made gold my hope, or said to find gold, I trust in you over God. Verse 25, if I have rejoiced because of my wealth, that it was great, and because my hand had gained much, if I had observed the sun when it shines, or the moon moving in brightness so that my heart has been secretly enticed, not guilty. Verse 29, if I have rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me, or lifted myself up when evil was found, not guilty. Verse 31, if men of my tent have not said, who is there that has not been satisfied with this man's meat? I have always treated people fairly. And a summation of verse 33, if I have covered my sin as Adam by hiding my iniquity in my bosom because I feared the great multitude and dreaded the contempt of families, I am not guilty. And he reaches the point in verse 38, even if my land cries out against me and its furrow weeps together, I have not mistreated the land. I am not guilty. And the end of verse 40, the words of Job are ended. He has nothing more to say. Baffled, questioning, tormented, now silent, like he was at the end of chapter 2 when his three friends came. He's not comparing himself to other people. Job is comparing himself to God. In his words, he is trying to bring God down to his level. In his mind, he is trying to elevate himself to the level of God. Remind you of anyone? Isaiah 14 and Lucifer. It is fitting that we conclude again with what we have already brought out before. I'll cite the scriptures as opposed to turning to them. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 28. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 28. His understanding is unsearchable. God's understanding no one can fathom. But Job tries to quantify God in a box of his own understanding, and that's impossible. He tries to bring God down to his own level of understanding, and that ain't possible. Why, as chapter 55 of Isaiah, verses 8 to 9 says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, my ways are not your ways, says the Lord, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Job has opened his mouth too often. He shuts it here, but he stirs up God. We could jump from here to chapter 40 when God now comes down to answer him. We'll save that for the final message, because there are some incisive comments that a young whippersnapper makes by the name of Elihu, whom we believe is the author of the book. And we'll look at Elihu's message next time.